Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to stay on top of all the latest news from China in only a few minutes a day through our email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, or at the website at subchina.com. SubChina offers uncensored reporting from and about China, and you can read about everything from media policy to the Me Too movement, from the U.S.-China trade war to China's ongoing draconian repression of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. We're sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I am coming to you today from the home of one of our guests today. You've heard him on the show before, our good friend Jim Millward. More on Jim and our topic anon. First, let us greet our beloved co-host, the best-known China watcher in all of Central Tennessee, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn, editor-in-chief of SubChina. Jeremy, I know, don't let that go to your head, and Greet the good listeners.
Kaiser, you, my friend, are a Yankee carpetbagger. And the evidence of this is that in Tennessee, we call it Middle Tennessee, not Central Tennessee. Okay. But thank you. Thank you very much for the kind welcome. I appreciate it.
Zhongtan. What is Tengnasi? Zhongtan. 你是中藤人. 我是北卡人. Okay. Anyway.
天纳西州.
Oh, 天. Yeah. Oh, it's not 腾纳西. It's 天纳西. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, 中天. Okay. Yeah. All right. So you're a 中天人.
Yeah. That's me.
你是个中天人. Okay. Anyway.
So it's Southern Tennessee, 天下.
It's 南天. 南天. Enough levity. We have to get on to serious topics.
Enough levity. Let's talk about genocide.
Yeah. China's treatment of ethnic minorities in the PRC, what Beijing still sometimes calls minority nationalities or 小数民族, has understandably been at the center of a great deal of discussion and the focus of a great deal of criticism. This has assumed a new urgency in the last 18 months with revelations of what is happening in Xinjiang, especially the so-called re-education training camps to which hundreds of thousands and perhaps even a million Uyghurs and Kazakhs have been sent on suspicion, often just completely fictitious suspicions of radical Islamist or separatist tendencies or sympathies. Today, we're going to get an update on what has happened in Xinjiang in recent months. We'll discuss how the situation in Xinjiang relates to what has happened in Tibet, and we'll delve into the PRC's approach to ethnic policy. We're also going to look at the ways to address and hopefully improve a situation that has become dire indeed. We're delighted to be joined by Tashi Rabge, who's a research professor of international affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University here in D.C. Tashi directs the research initiative on multinational states, RIMS, R-I-M-S, and the Tibet Governance Lab. She did a 7-year research exchange with Chinese State Council Development Research Center, the Institute for Ethnic Minority Affairs. That's the 国务院发展研究中心, 民族研究所. She is also the co-founder, along with her sister Losang Rabge, of Machik, which is an NGO that works on education, on capacity building, on innovation in Tibet. Tashi, we have wanted to get you on the show for a very long time, and we're just thrilled that you could finally come on.
Oh, good to be here.
Oh, we're really glad to have you.
We are also joined there, not here in my holler in Nashville, but there in Washington by Jim Millward, whose home has been taken over these last few days by the inconsiderate guest, Kaiser, and our colleague, Jason. Thank you very much for that, Jim. You really are a hero for putting up with that man. Jim is a professor of history at Georgetown and is the author of several books about Xinjiang and Central Asia, and has been on our program a number of times in the past to talk about Xinjiang-related issues. His books include very serious academic books as well as very light reads that are kind of, you know, an intelligent person's version of a dummy's guide to Xinjiang. So look them up. We'll post some links. Jim, welcome back to Seneca. I'm sorry I couldn't be there in your house with you.
Oh, well, thanks for having me in my own home. I'm pleased to be here too. No, I'm very pleased to be on the show.
It's like you're invited to a duck dinner, you bring the duck.
Right. Yes. Thanks for the duck, Jim. Jim, let's start actually with an update on Xinjiang. There have been still more revelations of the extent of the camps, including most recently there's been evidence uncovered by, I guess, first by Emily Fung of the Financial Times of forced labor. The Associated Press also reported on forced labor. They tracked shipments of athletic wear to a company called Badger, which is in my home state of North Carolina, in Statesville, I think. There's also been more responses from American lawmakers about this. So why don't you catch us up first? What more have we learned, and how are American and other international responses taking shape?
Yeah, well, as far as we know, the situation certainly hasn't gotten any less severe. The camps are either still expanding in their capacity and area, or certainly haven't shrunk any. And as you mentioned, the new development right now is that we're seeing more and more work facilities or factories in these camps. And recent reporting has revealed that this has become a sort of serious part of what the camps are doing. That people, once they quote unquote graduate from learning Chinese and sort of move on, then they're put into work in some kind of facilities, making textiles, shoes, some packaging, maybe electronics assembly, those sorts of things, for a period of time which we don't know about. So this is sort of the new development. I guess more broadly, over the last few months, one thing we've seen has been, after evolving for some time, the official story about what these camps are has now sort of settled down. At first, of course, as the listeners may know, China denied the existence of the camps. And then for a brief while, they floated a story that some 400,000 people had been relocated from their villages in southern Xinjiang to jobs programs elsewhere. And then when finally confronted at the UN about this story that they were vocational schools, emerged. And China has since put out a propaganda blitz backing that story up with articles and op-eds in Global Times. And in particular, domestically in China, CCTV released a 15-minute video piece that shows the camps, shows people working there, shows usually very not well-spoken, not well-educated Uyghur peasants speaking in halting Chinese and thanking the party for looking after them by interning them in these facilities.
Explain to me how this is positive propaganda.
Well, it's funny. One can, of course, look at it in different ways, but the argument is, I thank the party because otherwise I would have listened to this extremist propaganda, or these extremist messages. I didn't know, but thanks for putting me in these schools.
Propaganda.
Well, thanks for putting me in these schools. I now have learned how to take the right road. So it's this kind of...
This is a familiar type of propaganda in China, I think. I mean, I recall the TV series. I don't know if it's still running with the... It was a provincial TV station. I don't think it was Hunan. It may be Hunan. And she interviewed prisoners on death row. There is a kind of a tradition of this prison confessional, and it's an example to society. So I think the reception, I think it is effective in China. It's not effective in America or, Western countries, but...
No. Yeah, a lot of, Maoist echoes, of course, very part of this whole thing. It is a re-education...
Right.
Kind of.
So
plan.
If we could switch geographies and peoples, Tashi, how does the situation in Xinjiang relate to what's been going on in Tibet and ethnically Tibetan areas on the plateau? Just this week, there's been a little bit of news, some reported self-immolations. But before that, you know, the last 6 months or year or so, much of the news media coverage of oppression of ethnic minorities in China has been dominated by Xinjiang. So what's going on in Tibet now?
Well, in fact, what's been going on in Tibet has been continuous throughout this period. There were many similar practices put into place in Tibet prior to the recent kinds of policies we're describing now and really making a public issue. In fact, I think it's well known and well talked about, well discussed, that Chen Chuanguo was originally the first party secretary of the Tibet Autonomous Region, and that is where a lot of these practices were put into place initially.
Policing and...
Policing, the securitization of the whole issue of Tibet. And we saw literally the internment of innocent people, arbitrary, kind of random. If you had traveled to India, that would be a basis of rounding people up. So we had seen this since 2012 in Tibet and continues today.
Tashi, sorry to interrupt. Can I ask, did they construct new buildings in
camps,
Tibet
like camps,
to house
like...
camps? Yeah.
Well, we... As far as I know, I haven't seen the kind of evidence that we've seen now in Xinjiang, where satellite images are showing us the extent of the new constructions. A lot of the Tibetans who are rounded up, they are rounded up into school facilities that are used for political purposes now. And they've been using buildings that already exist, as far as I know.
If I can just jump in. So those kinds of repurposed facilities, schools, hospitals being used for re-education, quote-unquote re-education camps, they were in Xinjiang before Chen Chuanguo got there as well, on a much smaller scale. And so the departure is in the last year, year and a half, with this sudden expansion of size and the appearance of new purpose-built facilities on a much higher scale than we've seen before.
So if we turn back to Tibet, has there been an escalation of this kind of repressive, these repressive tactics in Tibet at the same time as there has in Xinjiang?
The scale does not seem to be what we're hearing about in Xinjiang, but the practices just continue. And I think there's a lot of contradictory practices being put into place that are hard to explain, really. And so increasingly, I think the surveillance through many different means is higher than ever before in history, even just to circumambulate around the Potala Palace, for example. Local Tibetans talk about it's harder than to, you know, get into an airport. And you have to do this six times. You have to go through a kind of an entire process of... With each circumambulation,
wow.
You do this, you know, that many times. I think Tibet has some certain characteristics that really set it aside. For example, one of the security measures is to put a fire extinguisher on every block.
Right.
So that is something unique to Tibet. But none of it makes sense. And of course, all it does is seed resentment. All it does is make people feel very alienated, more alienated than they already felt. So there's a lot of counterproductive things going
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely.
So I just want to quickly ask about self-immolations, because I mentioned, I noticed just in the last week, there were, I think, three new reports. What have the numbers been like of self-immolations? Because the news media hasn't really been covering it that I'm being aware of in the last 6 months or so.
Well, the total since they began, which was in 2009, is 155 self-immolators. I think what's really significant is how this has sat with the Tibetan people. And I think that there's a kind of silent mourning going on. Whether or not it's being covered in the media, it really sits on people's conscience. The fact that it is not something narrowly limited to monks and nuns. In particular, I'd point out that during the 18th Party Congress, where we saw the change in power, there were 28 self-immolations. That's pretty much one every day. And it was, you know, monks and nuns, as well as, you know, women and men, older people, a high school student. So, you know, really across the breadth of society is really involved in this. And the fact that this is pretty much the first time in modern human history we've seen self-immolation used as a political tool this significantly creates a weight, I think, in the Tibetan people's consciousness. And this is, I'm talking about people inside, to the extent that I've been working inside and continue to work with people inside. And I think that this is seeding future consequences because it is not it's not in the media headlines, it doesn't go away for a Tibetan person.
We're all trying to make sense of what's happening in Xinjiang and Tibet. And both Jim and you, Tashi, have talked about the importance of understanding changing Minzu policy. We're calling it Minzu policy because I think minority nationality policy isn't a particularly good translation. Minority ethnicity policy, ethnic policy. But so I think we're just for our listeners who don't speak Chinese, we're going to go with Minzu policy just as a word here. This is after you, Tashi. But in order to understand it, in order to make sense of it, I think we need to look at how that concept has gelled. I mean, I think it has roots that reach back. I think, Jim, you would probably say pre-Qing, right? Before the Qing Empire, which did incorporate a lot of these non-Han areas into the empire.
Well, first, when we say this word Minzu, a lot of your listeners do know Chinese, some may not. This is a relatively recent neologism, which came actually from a Japanese coinage.
Hmm.
And it was originally meant to translate words such as the German Volk.
Right?
It, with the rise of nationalism, as peoples in East Asia were trying to come up with terms to reflect those kinds of ideas. And it's later been glossed in China. It's been used to gloss Russian terms. So you know, the Russian term for nationality, nationalnost, particularly after the Soviet period. And one can go through the various terms, you know, and ways it's been used. Now it's translated into English, not as nationality, but as ethnicity sometimes. All of those translations are a little bit problematic because what we're really talking about is an idea and institutions that are evolving within China, just as sort of people's self-identity evolves and also as state institutions have changed, right? So you mentioned the Qing dynasty, and it's important to point out that one of the ways in which the Qing dealt with its empire, dealt with the fact that it had a very diverse population, both within China proper, but of course, once Mongolia was added and Xinjiang and Tibet, and of course the Manchus themselves, they were very aware of what we would call ethnic difference of these peoples. And they did, as empires do, they had a different approach to different peoples with different administrations, sometimes different legal systems, different types of officials in charge of different groups, depending on where they were. And again, this is not unique to China. It's something that empires do. You can call it imperial pluralism. That's sort of a fancy political science-y term. Sorry about that, Jeremy. But at bottom, it's very pragmatic, right? And it's as simple as, you know, you don't, for example, necessarily want to go in and insist that people in a new territory you've just taken control of switch their religion, right? If you're an imperial government, that's asking for trouble. So those sorts of things were very characteristic of the Qing, and this is something that scholarship on the Qing Empire has revealed over the last 10, 20 years or so. And then, of course, by the time we get to the PRC period from the 1950s, there was this new system which we call the Minzu system or Minzu policy, which in its basic institutional features and some of the terminology looks like the same system that the Soviet Union implemented, which has been called, you know, the affirmative action empire, terms like this, which recognizes from the top down and categorizes the different peoples of the state, and you know, gives them names. It channels resources to them. Sometimes it gives them a territorial. It gives them a territory, be it a, you know, county or a prefecture or even province-sized territory. Yeah, right. So this is where we get the autonomous regions of Xinjiang and Tibet, for example, from that. Now, generally, it's thought that China simply adopted a Soviet system, and they did adopt the forms of it. But there are some very important differences. For example, the Soviet system in theory allowed for secession of these peoples. That, of course, was, you know, was theoretical, never really real. Theoretical. But nonetheless, you know, China would never sort of go that far. That's a fundamental difference. So if you see them as slavishly following Soviet practices, that's a significant difference. But I think also that there, in the underlying thinking, there's a lot of carryover from Imperial China, a lot of carryover from the Republican period. You remember that, you know, the first flags of the Republican period had five different colors, five stripes representing the five minzu then of China, right? That was, I would say, expanded to 56, but the same idea that this former empire would become a multinational state is carried through into the PRC period. So that's, when we talk about the Minzu system, that's roughly what we're talking about.
But now, and this is a question for both of you, I think this has shifted, right? It seems to me that now there is a much more assimilationist approach. And if the Communist Party, you know, had their wildest dream, they would go back to 1949 and rewrite the policy to try and kind of Hanhua everybody, assimilate everybody. Is that impression misguided, or is there something there?
I wouldn't say that it's an about face. I'm not sure there was a period when there wasn't an assimilationist trend. But that has accelerated, and I think particularly after the fall of the Soviet Union, which caused a lot of anxiety among the Chinese leadership, and that's when we saw the language, you know, around Zhonghua Minzu, this new category that has come to be central, a central signifier for a lot of intellectuals, thinkers on minority policy today. So what that has meant is that the whole Minzu model that you've just described, Jim, is being mobilized to really enhance the assimilationism. And this is part of the problem, I think, that has led to the securitization of the regions we're talking about, Tibet and Xinjiang.
Yeah, there's a white paper about Xinjiang came out just in the last couple of weeks. And there's some really interesting, subtle but interesting changes in it. The way in which the Chinese Communist Party talks about ethnic difference, and has been really since the 80s, was, you know, to have the 56 Minzu, right? But then there was a recognition that there was something known as a Zhonghua Minzu, a Chinese Minzu. And in a formulation by Fei Xiaotong, a very famous anthropologist, he talked about this Zhonghua Minzu being a higher level identity that sits on top of and is a sort of the crystallization.
Trans-ethnic national identity.
But literally, I mean, he describes it as sort of higher and rising out of that. And the argument was you can have multiple forms of identity or multiple foci of identity. And that's something that, you know, anthropologists would agree with. In the recent white paper, though, you see the Zhonghua Minzu being talked about as the source, the foundation, the base of other Minzu. And there have been other pieces of propaganda and arguments that have suggested that this former idea of Fei Xiaotong is being flipped upside down.
Yeah, it's a total inversion of history.
That there is something that everybody was Zhonghua Minzu and they've deviated somehow from that. And this is a repetition, actually, of a line that Chiang Kai-shek took in the Republican period. He wasn't talking about Minzu, he talked about Zongzu, he talked about race. But he had argued that everyone in China, all the former imperial subjects of the Qing, were members of the yellow race originally, and that they had since deviated for geographical and historical reasons, but that they would all end up being sort of Chinese again. So we're back to that kind of formulation without race being the terminology.
Yeah, that recalls, actually, there was an editorial in the, where was it? It was, I think, in the Xinjiang Party paper, maybe the Urumqi Ribao, by
the mayor of Urumqi, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the mayor, right. And he said that the idea that Uyghurs are Turkic is nonsense.
Right. The Uyghurs are not, they're not descendants of the Turkic people. They're only from Zhonghua. And that's precisely this new line, this new argument about that. So they flipped this upside down, and this is really signaling the assimilationist direction, I think.
Tashi, I'd love to hear about, I mean, I think there's really not much awareness outside of a very small circle of scholarly types outside of China who follow it closely, but to hear how people in China debate and discuss the issue of Minzu policy. I mean, not just within the party, but also maybe in a broader public. There's this idea of this second generation of Minzu policy, a 第二代 Minzu 政策. Can you tell us about what this second generation sort of means typically, what it's all about, and perhaps, you know, what we can kind of learn from this debate that's happening about the policy?
Sure. I actually want to go one step back and talk about the Minzu framework and why that is in itself a big problem for situations like Tibet and
Xinjiang.
Sure,
yeah, absolutely.
So this framework, which was, as Jim pointed out, put together in the 1950s, the whole classification process of taxonomizing basically all of the people in this new modern Chinese state, what it did was to flatten and to artificially make equal all these different kinds of subjectivities, some that were more or less invented or feels invented. There's this one really interesting case of a study of what was thought of as a classic Chinese rural area based on fieldwork in the 1930s. And these people later discovered in the 1950s that they were Bai. Baizu. Uh-huh. And they had not known that ethnic label Bai before. So there's a, what we call state ethnogenesis going on as well. Right. And this is entirely different than something like Tibet, for example, which was so distinctive, there was no need to be
right.
told
it was
what
organically
the
ethnic, emerging
right.
one.
In
right.
fact, the Tibetans were the only later classified Shaoxu Minzu who had an agreement with the central government in order to become incorporated into the People's Republic of China, right? So there's no other Shaoxu Minzu with an agreement trying to explain how this is stuck together. So what's happened is that in this framework of 56 Minzu, you have apples and oranges being treated the same. So that is one major problem. And so what's happened is that Chinese intellectuals and thought leaders have come along and said, we need to fix this. This is incoherent. And we have all this evidence of things not really having led to social cohesion, which mm-hmm. is absolutely true. So
that's the thrust of who the second generation guys
yes,
are.
Okay. Yes, and Professor Marong at Beijing University has been pivotal. He was actually the first person to valiantly, he tried very hard to change the conversation and change the thinking on how to...
Sorry, Tashi, can you say his name again?
Marong.
Yeah. Marong.
Mm-hmm.
Thank
so
you.
So he's the chair of sociology and anthropology at Beijing University. Because his kind of maverick thinking precipitated some of the security issues that arose later in the decade. But he really started publishing outside of academic journals, so really made a push to make it a public conversation within a broader space. So he used to write about this, but buried in academic journals that nobody reads, and then he suddenly started writing about it very publicly. And this got picked up after all of the issues started to arise inside these regions. Essentially, he is referring to places like Tibet. He has a strong concern about Tibet. And his solution was and he has a phrase for this, 去政治化. So to depoliticize the issue. And his recommendation was that this concept of Minzu needed to be, he called it 文化化. To culturalize it, to make it a culture so that it's deracinated, it's taken away from any connection to a particular place, and it's just a floating identity that can be the same. You can be equally Tibetan in Lhasa as you can in Shanghai. But the truth is Tibetans tend not to live in Shanghai.
Right.
Even the ones who've been taken out of the region in order to, there's an education program where they take middle schoolers out and they keep them in inland China and Neidi for many, many years until they finish college. So that's a long time, and often they don't get to go back to their homelands in that period. And still, when they finish, they don't stay in Shanghai or Guangzhou, wherever they were educated. They all go back to Tibet. So this, the fact of the matter
because
is...
Because they have to.
No,
because they have to go.
They don't have to. They can find... There are ways to find, jobs and opportunities in the inland areas, but overwhelmingly, I've interviewed many of these young people. They've been part of this program since... they've been having this program since 1988, and they go back. My point being that... It was Professor Marong's idea is in theory, but in practice, not so meaningful.
It's a lovely cosmopolitan fancy,
yes.
But it's just not, yeah.
Right.
So, it's unfortunate, though. I'm interested, did he get any pushback officially? Were there people who wanted to keep that idea sort of,
right.
in the bowels of the ivory tower?
he picked up a lot of incredible interest publicly. There were people, very high profile academics in other areas, like Huang Gang, for example, who writes about the economy and other areas, but they enthusiastically got behind this, and this is where the Diardai Minzu Zhengce whole program emerged. And at the same time, officially, they got massive pushback, and especially led by Shaoshu Minzu intellectuals, Hui and near Mongolians, for example. You know who didn't push back, generally speaking?
The Tibetans.
Tibetans and the Uyghurs. You know why? Because it's too darn dangerous. So I think this is really important to know, that the people who have the most at stake were silent on this. So, but there was a lot of pushback, and the Mongolians especially, they were meeting all over the world about
this. Tasha, give me a time frame. When was this conversation happening? When did this really start?
So post-2008, it really picked up speed.
And 2009, I imagine.
Exactly. So throughout this process, I was in these meetings with different policy researchers about the issue of Tibet. And so I really got a lot of insight into the degree to which they thought this was very dangerous, that it was highly unpragmatic, and that this, however much that this appealed to Chinese, who really kind of idealized the idea of America's approach to ethnicity, and this is what they want to implement in the PRC, that they couldn't do it institutionally. So one of the things that I wanted to bring up is, and thank you, Kaiser, for keeping Minzu untranslatable, because that's what I think it is. We have really made a mess of this concept. We used to translate it nationality, right, back in the day. And so there's the very important piece of the constitutional provision called that establishes the Minzu Qu Zizhifa, right, the autonomy law. And we used to translate it NRAL, Nationality Regional Autonomy Law. Then there was a time that we started to call it the Minority Regional Autonomy Law, right? And of course, Minzu doesn't mean minority, because the Han are also Minzu.
Right.
But we did it anyway. So for a long time, we used to call it the MRAL. And these days, I think in the State Department and elsewhere, the standard way to write it is REAL, right? Regional Ethnic Autonomy Law. That is our standard in English and in academic discourse. But the truth is that in the PRC, in China, it is a contested concept. Yeah. It's a contested term. And so Maron did try to popularize the idea of Zuqun, which in Taiwan is easily used because they use that. That was a neologism too. Well, it was developed to capture the idea of ethnicity in the U.S. as we use it in sociology. Right?
Ah, I see. Zuqun.
Zuqun, okay. Yeah. And so Maron did try in some of his writing to bring this concept into the whole conversation. I don't think it stuck. And so we're still trying to figure out how Minzu
will be used.
First
time I've heard that word. Apparently it didn't stick.
You know,
Can I change tack? I think let's not get too much into the weeds about Maron. Are there other voices in this debate, aside from Maron, that are offering an alternative vision for ethnic policy in China that is not the post-49 policy and is not Maron's vision?
Yes.
Is there any debate?
Yes, there is. And so I wouldn't say that the Diardai Minzu Zhengce is encompassed. That whole idea is encompassed by what Maron initially did. I think a lot of other people who aren't thought of as experts in the field have pushed that forward as more of a kind of a political agenda. And I do think that's been sort of put away. But there are a lot of people trying now to think experimentally. And one that, Jim, you and I were talking about recently is the whole idea of liberal multiculturalism, trying to apply that in China. So there are a lot of scholars, writers, thinkers who are trying to conceive of China as a multicultural political space. And the unfortunate thing is that China, just like trying to talk about rule of law in China, is kind of nonsensical, right? And so to try to talk about multiculturalism in China is also kind of like that. So
how do you mean? I mean, what do you run up against when you, I mean, is it simply just too much of a sort of fantastic liberal concept that it's just utterly inapplicable to Chinese realities, or
right.
what is it?
I think that our basic problem is that we're taking liberal concepts, liberal frameworks, and projecting them onto a context where those conditions for a liberal society doesn't exist, right, to an authoritarian society, right? So when you have that, I think liberal multiculturalism, as it was developed in places like Canada or different European countries, you have a certain openness for contestation, right? You do not have that in the PRC right now. So to think that this can be easily applied is really misleading. And it's led to strange recommendations, like, for example, looking at the Manchu as a great example of how there has been multiculturalism in China. Because from a Tibetan point of view, from a lot of, you know, other point of view, you would say that...
Who's suggesting this?
Oh, people who are, you know, out there
but,
publishing.
But, I mean, that is a defeated nationality. That is, I mean, it's been so completely assimilated.
It's not presented as defeated, even though one would think it is. And it's a dreadful example. But
Right. Interesting. Yeah.
I was just going to point out, it's worth sort of stopping and thinking that, recognizing that there was this debate about a very fundamental aspect of the PRC system, you know, the Minzu system, mm-hmm. for a few years, between thought leaders, as Tashi said, scholars, who were really reflecting very, very different points of view about this fundamental issue. So that's quite interesting to note, right? I think what's happened in the last few years is that debate has been squelched.
Right.
And some people, it's hard to say exactly where that got cut off, but some people point to Xi Jinping had a central work conference about ethnicity issues it was 2014. Yeah. And that was interpreted, you know, his various utterances there were interpreted by different sides of the debate in different ways. But looking back at it now, and James Leybold has written about this and wrote about it at the time, actually, as a significant event. She said that for ethnic problems that you had to look not just at material issues, but at spiritual issues as well. And what he was signaling there was that raising standards of living through development clearly was not going to work as a way of resolving these separatist issues, that you needed to look at, you know, Jingshan Shang the kind of problems as well.
That doesn't sound wrong to me.
But except it was a change over what was up to that point the at least officially stated approach to dealing with separatism, at least in Xinjiang, which was once the... You know, economic conditions have been improved, then people will, you know, lose these separatist concerns. That was, you know, the argument behind the, you know, open up the Great West and all of these kinds of policies. So, and he also, you know, introduced a concept of the four recognizes, I think, that they're four Chinese things. So people have to recognize that they're Chinese this way, that way. And so looking back on that now, he was, I think, signaling this shift, and as people have picked up on those signals, there's been less room for this debate, and this is where the assimilationist turn has begun and it's going now.
Okay, so what's the goal? What's the end goal of this? I mean, is it simply assimilation? Is that now what nationality policy in China, what Minzu policy is aimed at?
So thank you for asking that question, because I think one of the things that gets overlooked in that moment that we just witnessed, where mm-hmm. everyone's trying to experiment with thinking about the Minzu framework, is something that also came out of Professor Marong's writing. He talked about why we need to do this whole adjustment, right? The Chuzhong Zhihua, right? And he said one of the reasons is because we need to undermine this idea of Ling Tu Yi Shi.
Uh-huh.
So territorial
localism
consciousness. So this is one of the things that I've been trying to put out there is the idea that to ethnicize the whole issue, especially of places like Tibet and Xinjiang, which are substantially different than all the other Minzus. Right. And Xinjiang is different from Tibet. We're talking about very different kinds of things.
Mongols, you might. For some purposes, including with Xinjiang and Tibet.
They are interesting in a very complex way and very, very interested in the whole RIMS multinations state kind of conversation. So it's really interesting with the Neimonggu, where that conversation can go. But the point is that there is this push to ethnicize all of this, and it is very self-conscious that this is to take away from the visibility or the clarity of the issue of the relationship to the land. And so one of the things that I think through new new approach, for example, through thinking about territorial politics or what I call territoriality, is to be able to see that again. It's been a long time since we've been able to make visible the relationship between peoples and the space, the political space that we're talking about. In the Tibetan case, it's very obvious because we're talking about an area of average elevation 14,000 feet.
Right.
And we're talking about a very large area. It's the size of Western Europe. So this thing is distinctive for a lot of people. As soon as they get onto the plateau, it's very uncomfortable, physically uncomfortable. So there's something distinctive, but it's the same logic anywhere, which is that there is a relationship between this continuous inhabitation of this area by these people who have a distinctive language and culture, et cetera, what their consciousness is, right? So it's not something that can be easily...
Is here to stay.
Right. It's not something that can be easily made into a floating ethnic identity that can be, you know, anywhere. And so I think that in terms of you're asking where is this going, I think one is to try to obscure that and to really convince especially the global conversation, especially with academics, and believe me, it's been very successful, to talk about minority rights in an almost celebratory way. You know, and there's an assumption about the emancipatory potential of this framework, that this is really going to solve the problem. And this is why we see so many contradictory end results, like lifting up the Manchu example, like this is something good.
So can I maybe rephrase? I mean, hopefully I won't butcher what you just said, but, you know, so from the point of view of a Uyghur separatist, what you just said is very simple. Of course, he will say, or she will say, East Turkestan is our land and the Chinese took it over. That's why we have this, you know, territorial, so-called territorial consciousness or historical consciousness. So in a way, what you're saying is that, and I agree, and I understand what you're saying now, is that when Western commentators or even Western, you know, activists who are very concerned about these issues use the vocabulary of minorities, we talk about Uyghurs, Tibetans, maybe Mongols as minorities in China, we're obscuring the fact that really it's a post-colonial situation, or maybe still colonial situation, and that these territories are...
They're majorities, actually.
Well, right.
So people have been colonized.
Exactly. People in majorities in their own territory, and those territories, you know, were taken over, and we can argue the history about that, and whether it was the Qing, or whether it was 1949, or 1951, or 59, but, you know, basically that's the situation. And to talk about them as minorities of China... then is to obscure that.
Is that what you meant, Tasia? I'm not...
That is a part of it, yes. And so I think that what you just said, Jeremy... What you just said, Jeremy, is exactly right. Tibetans, generally speaking, feel like a majority in the Tibetan region. And because people tend not to grow roots. There are a lot of migrants. There's a lot of, you know, the state apparatus, of course, firmly based there, of course, and the military presence, etc. But it rotates, it migrates, and it doesn't stay. There's no deep roots, as I think that in Inner Mongolia and elsewhere, there are deep roots now. There are settlements that are not going away. But in that sense, then Tibetans do have this continuing sense of being a majority on this land.
Right.
And that's different from Xinjiang, I think, because there are a lot of Han people who've been in Xinjiang since the 50s. I am even related to some of them. And they think of that as, you know, their place. They're not going anywhere else. They have a very nice life in Kalamayi. I don't think there's an equivalent to that in Tibet, is there?
There certainly is in South Africa. that's fascinating. I think I've heard, Jim, you've argued this before. I know that it's a topic that, Tasi, you've also tackled quite extensively. This idea that China historically has actually shown quite a bit of creativity, quite a bit of maybe flexibility when it comes to understanding territoriality, to use your word, Tasi. You have one country, two systems. You have this whole system of autonomous regions. You have special economic zones. You have, you know, things like Shanghai, the free trade zone, where there's a different system of governance on a territory that's still notionally part of the People's Republic of China. Can you share your ideas about territoriality in China and how you think maybe Beijing could draw on this? And I want to turn first to you, Tasi, because you've done really interesting work in this thing that I mentioned at the beginning, RIMS, which stands for the Research Initiative on Multinational States, where you've actually gone to other geographies where there are active separatist movements or where there are ethnicities with a strong territorial claim. For example, the Basques, the Quebecois, the Kurds, maybe have you done Kurds? And I guess, the Scots, right? Can you talk about that and what lessons? Well, I think what was really interesting to me is earlier you said that the Basques are sending a delegation to China.
They've requested that they send a delegation and that RIMS facilitate this visit. And the Chinese scholars who were present at the meeting warmly reacted to that.
Great.
So we're working out that that whole project, which will be really exciting because they want an opportunity to give presentations on their model of autonomy. And so immediately they were invited to Shanghai, Beijing, but also to Hohhot. There's a new institute established in Inner Mongolia to look at different approaches to multi-nation states. And so this you're absolutely right. The Inner Mongolians have great potential to facilitate new kinds of conversations in a way that I think in Tibet and Xinjiang, it's kind of going to be difficult for the time being. But it has been a really wonderful opportunity to really explore some ideas about how to be flexible and creative around thinking about rearrangements of the existing structure. And I'm really, really pleased, especially we were able to have some very senior scholars coming from elite institutions in Beijing, Shanghai, and elsewhere, Chengdu as well, to participate in this meeting that involved a lot of political theorists from these places that you've mentioned, from Scotland and Quebec and elsewhere, but really focusing on the Basque experience, which has been remarkable. So a few weeks before we had our meeting this June, ETA, their homegrown terrorist movement, self-dissolved, right? To great flourish. And they destroyed all their weapons and they put out a statement saying, you know, there's been a historical need for us to exist, but that cycle is over and now we are choosing to shut ourselves down. So that was the natural conversation. How does that kind of political violence choose to shut itself down, right? So this was the kind of conversation we were able to have with these senior scholars. And the core of the meeting was really to say, can we reframe the issues so that we're looking at rearrangements, special status arrangements that can be achieved, and what are some good examples of that?
Wow.
So there's so much possibility with this, you know, thinking about territoriality in new ways. And I mean, I'm trying to argue anytime I get a chance to talk about this that China and Imperial China has been doing this for a long time. If I can tell a very brief historical anecdote, the 1830s in the Kashgar area, the Qing had problems with a Central Asian state known as Kokand, and they were sending traders in, and friction came up. There was an incursion. In the end, the way the Qing dealt with this was by having a treaty with the Kokandis. And that treaty allowed Kokandi merchants to live in Kashgar, to tax other merchants, to follow their own laws, and to basically enjoy extraterritoriality in Kashgar in order to deal with this problem of merchants on the frontiers who wanted to trade. So there's 1835. The Manchu officials in charge of that and dealing with those issues were then transferred down to the southern coast, where they dealt with some of the coastal regions, coastal issues there, having to do with, obviously, the British traders.
Right, right.
And so if you look again from that perspective at the Treaty of Nanking, so 1841, and its implementation over the next couple of years, what do you see? You see the creation of trade enclaves, the treaty ports. You see extraterritoriality. You see allowing a certain amount of merchant autonomy. And you see what's called most favored nation clause, a little bit confusingly, but what that essentially says is what the British got, other nations got too, right? Now, we traditionally look at this as obviously that,
something
this is
subjected, something visited on them.
Imposed upon, which it is, of course. Right. I don't mean to downplay the imperialism of the British, but I think we, amidst all the talk about a century of humiliation, you need to recognize that the Qing dealt with that in a very creative way. They didn't give the British what they wanted. They gave them trade enclaves on the frontiers. They ceded a little bit of sovereignty, letting the barbarians deal with their own legal issues in these treaty ports, and basically solved the situation of the British and other Westerners on the coast the same way they dealt with inter-Asian problems. If you go back to the Song Dynasty, there were Arab traders in Guangzhou, in Canton now. They enjoyed many of the same kinds of privileges within their cantonments as the treaty port foreigners did later on.
So, Jim, sorry to interrupt. Are you suggesting that there's a historical precedent for the Chinese government, for the Communist Party, to allow Uyghurs and Tibetans to have a real autonomy?
Yeah, so look at what has happened under the PRC, right? The special economic zones, one country, two systems, autonomous regions. These are all versions of the same kind of creative thinking about territoriality, reallocating sovereignty in creative ways in order to deal with problems of ethnicity, with issues of ethnicity, with issues of foreign trade, and so on. And I'm saying that China was actually implementing these, and this is why it's not simply a Soviet system, right? They're following much older Chinese traditions with this. They're turning their back on those approaches, I would say, and chasing the will of the wisp of a homogeneous national identity, which of course has never really worked very well anywhere and doesn't really exist. So I'm saying that China should actually look to its own traditions for creative ways of dealing with territoriality and sovereignty as a way of addressing the problems in Xinjiang and Tibet.
But is there any evidence, Jim, that any of the global criticism of China as regards Tibet and more recently Xinjiang is sinking in at all? Are there any signs Beijing might be reevaluating its current policies?
I don't think so. Not yet. No, they've really buckled down, and pumped out propaganda, as I was saying, behind the new line. There is more global pushback, not just from a few Western countries, but recently we've seen, Malaysia at the top political levels have made statements about this. Just the other day in Indonesia, the Ulema Council, which is the sort of the highest Islamic group in Indonesia, was calling on the Indonesian president to condemn what's going on in Xinjiang. There've been
And the Islamic, the Organization of Islamic Cooperative States or something like that, also tweeted at least a statement.
Right, they had a briefing about it, so they are publicly talking about it at least, right. And that's important. That represents 57 Muslim nations internationally, 1.8 billion people. So it may be beginning to filter up into the political levels of the Muslim world.
So let's talk a little bit about the global public conversation, both on Tibet and Xinjiang. But let's start with Tibet and you, Tashi. Do you think we've tended, that is especially here in the United States, to frame the issue too much through the eyes of Richard Gere?
By which you mean U.S.-China relations rather than...
No, I don't mean U.S.-China relations. I mean a kind of a hippie, mystic idea that, Tibet is this place where you can be enlightened and that's why we care. That's what I think one of the problems in the discussion in the United States and much of Europe has been, is that the hippies kind of took over the conversation.
Kurdistan has no appeal to the hippies, right?
Well, I wish it were just that. I also feel that there's a lot of conversation around that in elite Chinese circles. And at the same time, there's a lot of exoticization of Tibet, in those kinds of communities, too. So I think that the really prominent issue that needs to be looked at, I think, very critically, is about the shrinking of what we can talk about and how we can perceive the problem. And I can really only speak to Tibet on this. I know Xinjiang is a whole other kettle of fish. It has its own historical sort of trajectory that's different. But in the case of Tibet, it was really through the fall of the Berlin Wall and that moment, Tiananmen Square, the massacre there. And in the aftermath of that, the Tibet issue really attracted a global interest. Mm-hmm. And it had a lot to do with that moment of triumphalism that people felt in Western liberal democracies. We blame Francis Fukuyama, but it's not just his fault. He was just the messenger. And in any case, what we saw was that Tibet became such a well-known issue globally, right? At that moment, it became tied to the MFN, Most Favored Nation Status debate. And the end result was to my mind, the shrinkage of the issue. Before that, it was very common to hear conversations among elite Chinese scholars about the Tibet issue. Right?
What do you Shizang mean Wenji. Exactly by the shrinkage of the issue?
Well, through that process, the way that Tibet could be conceptualized and formulated became all about two things, human rights and religious freedom. And those two things have become the way that it's possible to talk about it and possible to imagine what is at stake.
To the exclusion of what other important, do you think?
To the exclusion of, for example, how people in the region are actually perceiving what the problem is. So for example, right, here's the test that I think is helpful to think about. If all Tibetan political prisoners were released today, does the issue go away tomorrow, right? It doesn't, because the same people will write something, they'll, you know, post something, they'll do something that gets them back into jail within 6 months, a year. We see it all the time. Right. And then they're released and then the entire community comes out to welcome them and treats them like heroes. And then they'll do it again. So there's something more at stake, more at issue. And because we haven't been able to talk about it in these multifaceted, multidimensional ways, then we follow this formula that doesn't help us. And that, I think that's led to this kind of moment where we have prominent Western scholars who really do embrace this conversation around liberal multiculturalism, like that's going to fix the problem, and it's not.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn that same question to Xinjiang. I mean, do you think that there's also a danger when it comes to look at Xinjiang right now, especially now, you know, with the Xinjiang atrocities happening at a very moment of extremely high tension between China and the United States, that this is sort of now a U.S.-China issue, or it's being maybe jumbled in and packaged with a lot of other sort of U.S.-China bilateral issues?
Well, certainly there's a lot of issues that have all come up at the same time, right? And
right.
It's interesting to see, you know, the strongest voices within the U.S. government, Senator Marco Rubio, Vice President Pence, you know, those two voices most prominently have mentioned it. Pompeo, Secretary of State Pompeo, have mentioned the Xinjiang issues, not the president yet. That's not really the point. But it's not coming that broadly from, well, it's not necessarily coming from traditional progressives or even the traditional human rights people concerned about human rights in China, as much as it's coming, I think, sort of from a Cold Warrior kind of perspective, from people with strong concerns for, you know, religious freedom, but coming from their own religious belief. So from the Christian right, really.
Right.
And so insofar as those of us who are very, very concerned about what's going on in Xinjiang, you know, including the professorate now who work on this, you know, we're very, very pleased to see anybody talking about it at all and making it public at all. I think that's very important. But if it's going to be one among a raft of issues used to, you know, to bash China, right, that I'm a little less sanguine about that. On the other hand, you know, these things need to be called out, right? And somebody is doing it. So I give credit to Senator Rubio in particular. There is a good possible sign on the horizon. There is a bill now in Congress called something like the Uyghur Rights. I've forgotten the actual name, but Uyghur Rights Recognition Act or something like this. That's basically going to be, if it is passed and it has some bipartisan support in both houses, it will be calling on the administration to implement global Magnitsky sanctions and some other sorts of things. And that is coming from a bipartisan background. It as yet doesn't have prominent Democratic Party sponsors.
Have they drawn up a list of people?
I just looked it up, Jim. It's H.R. 7123, Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act of 2018.
Yes.
Okay.
And so that's, you know, that's there, and we're sort of waiting to see what happens with that. I mean, this is a problem. I think we are at an inflection point in U.S.-China relations. A lot of former panda huggers are now questioning, maybe we're considering a trial separation from the panda for some time. And yeah, it is being rolled into the broader story, absolutely. I don't know how that could be avoided.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, this is fascinating stuff, Tashi and Jim both. It's great that you both took the time to join us. We do need to get to recommendations. Before we do that, I'll very quickly remind our listeners that the Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina. And if you enjoy all the work that we do, the best thing that you can do to support us is to sign up for SubChina Access. Your support makes it possible for us to keep bringing you the reporting, the podcast conversations, the videos, the whole lot of it. Great. Now, on to recommendations. Jeremy, let's try to be economical here. What do you have?
Okay, so mine is a little like a recent recommendation, a graphic novel version of the Epic of Gilgamesh. Today, I recommend Paradise Lost, John Milton's poem, in the graphic novel version by Pablo Auladel. And I've been reading it with my daughter, and it's really fun. Well, it's not fun. It's actually kind of weird, but, you know, I'll probably... Maybe I've, in fact, totally screwed her for life by reading her Paradise Lost at the age of 6. But I'm at least being educated once again about this magnificent poem.
Outstanding, outstanding. Tashi, you're up next. What do you have for us?
I'd like to recommend the movie Jimba, which I don't know if you've had a chance to talk about on this program yet, but it's the latest film by the leading Tibetan filmmaker who's based in Beijing and in Xining, Bema Tsete, and it's amazing. So it just won, the best screenplay at the Venice International Film Festival. Yep, and I got a chance to see it in Toronto. It's not released yet in the US, but it will be very soon in the coming months.
Jimba,
and it's
called.
Fantastic.
Jimba.
Jimba, yes.
Great. Jimbo?
I knew you were going there, Kaiser. All right, well, this is in the naked self-promotion category of recommendations, or at least, I suppose, familial self-promotion. I want to recommend another podcast for your listeners who, by definition, like smart, current events-y podcasts. And this is a new podcast that's released daily by the Washington Post. It's called Post Reports. And my wife, Madhulika Sikka, is the executive producer, so that's why this is self-promotion. But it's a wonderful 20-minute podcast that it's not a rundown of the news. It usually has one story that's news of the day and then a couple other really interesting things drawn from the pages of the Post, but you get a conversation with the reporters. It's nicely produced, good music, wonderful voices. I'm really enjoying it, so I urge everyone to subscribe and listen.
I will absolutely. I mean, I'm going to kick Michael Barbaro off of my my phone and listen to this.
Yes, we're not listening to other newspaper podcasts anymore.
No more. They're gone. Awesome. Mine is for Fulinmen Daohuaxiang rice. I've been, you know, searching around in America for the best rice available commonly in these big chain grocery stores. And I'm a big fan of the Dongbei rice, of, you know, stuff that's grown in the black soil of Heilongjiang.
You like the cadmium.
I love the cadmium, the delicious cadmium taste. No, it's just amazing rice, though. Fulinmen Daohuaxiang.
No, the cadmium is good, Kaiser. It's very
you know,
nice.
Mean heavy metal, right? But it's amazing rice. It has that kind of fragrance to it. It's medium grain. It's just
Where do you get it online?
You can get it online. I've looked it up. You can buy it actually from a bunch of different stores. It's a bit pricey. It's about, you know, 10 or 11 bucks for just a 2-kilogram bag. You can get, you know, big bags of it at grocery stores. I pay about 20 bucks now for one of the big bags. I think they're 5-kilo bags or something. But, you know, well worth it if you're a rice guy, as I am.
I got a lot of rice people in my family, I have to say, so.
My son told me a joke the other day. He said, what do you call an Australian who's prejudiced against East Asian people? I said, what? A ricist, he said.
Your son is already making dad jokes.
And with that, okay. Right. Jokes told to dad. Once again,
Jin Chu Yulan or Sheng Yulan, right?
Yeah, exactly. The apple don't fall far from the tree. Tashi, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate
Jim,
it.
Great, and thanks again. Jim, once
thanks, Tashi. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Kaiser.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn and edited by Jason McRonald and me. Special thanks this week to our guest, Jim Millward, who was kind enough to let us convert his dining room into a makeshift studio. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, New Voices, China Econ Talk, and Ta for Ta. more great shows coming soon, and really soon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Take care.